Penguin Random House Canada presents Firebrand, A Tobacco Lawyer's Journey by Joshua Nillman. Read for you by Andrew Shaver. Author note read by Joshua Nillman. Illusion is the first of all pleasures. Voltaire. For Judith Nillman and Sylvia Austrey, Wise Ones.
Author's note. This is a selfish book. For some readers, it may hold value as an exploration of the contemporary tobacco industry, a crash course in global marketing, or a primer on multinational business careers. After all, this story spans more than a dozen countries. Other curious souls may simply appreciate a passport stamped with so much ink. I wrote it, though, because I'm a smoker, and I got hooked on this international adventure connected to the most contentious and dangerous mass-market consumer product in the history of the world. Over a drink at a bar, I first met the man at the center of this narrative, who worked in the tobacco industry as legal counsel for over a decade, and for a variety of multinational companies. He was engaging and a gifted storyteller. I was drawn in and inhaled the information and the intelligence being offered. Despite years of repelling sustained attacks, he pointed out, the tobacco industry was thriving. After that first conversation, I was struck by how little I knew about the product to which I had become addicted, and my curiosity was stoked by a burning question. So I asked for a second meeting and posed it. How had an entire globalized industry managed to survive decades of intense and sustained assault by the medical and scientific establishment and from governments around the world while keeping its product on the shelf? He nodded and smiled. That's the trillion-dollar question, isn't it? I can do my best to explain it to you. Our interviews took place over the next 10 years. It felt distinctly absurd to gain more and more knowledge about this popular and deadly consumer product from someone who had helped market it to the world, even as I bought it and used it daily, struggling with my ferocious addiction. I hope you enjoy reading about the tobacco paradox taking place across our globe as much as I enjoyed listening and learning about it. Names have been changed, but the truth remains. As someone who has smoked tens of thousands of cigarettes, I wanted, it turned out, to know more about the thing that may kill me. Who wouldn't, I guess? JK, Toronto, 2022.
Interviews. Until the age of 11, he wanted to be a pirate. Then he decided he wanted to be the next Johnny Carson. So he chased a job working for NBC, Johnny's network, and got one in its news department in the UK. Just a few months into it, though, he realized he'd never make any money at journalism, so he applied to law school. Well, applied is a loose term. It was his father who provided the strategy. Go inquire at the most prestigious schools and find out if any prospective students had dropped out. He followed his dad's advice, visited admissions offices across London, and got lucky. At one law school, the secretary asked him about grades, and, of course, he'd brought his transcript. She examined the documents, looked at him, and said if he could pay a deposit by the end of day, the spot was his. He paid and gained entrance to one of the best law schools in Britain. For 2 years, he worked his ass off, and at the end of it, he passed his law finals. In the UK, becoming a lawyer is not exactly like it is in the US or in Canada, where he'd grown up. In Britain, you went to university, you went to law school, you took your bar exams, and then you had to work 2 years as an apprentice. You then became a solicitor. And a few years after that, you could practice on your own. Since the intake of lawyers was completely determined by the private sector, a lot of people who went to law school never actually became lawyers. There were simply not enough positions. Luck was with him again when he graduated. He was recruited as one of only two new lawyers by an entertainment law firm. Even better, their offices weren't in a corporate tower, but in a renovated Fashion District warehouse. Serendipity. He got the job not only because he had attended an excellent school, but also, he thinks, because he'd worked as a journalist with NBC. The journalism experience gave his resume some edge. It was 1998, and this second millennium seemed to close in his favor. At 24 years old, he had a law degree and a starter career at a boutique law outfit. It was the stuff of dreams. The only problem, everyone else at the new firm seemed cool, and he was not. This sad fact was reflected in his new responsibilities. He was immediately assigned to all the uncool work: advertising, trademarks, branding, the boring stuff. He didn't get his own office. Instead, he shared a room with someone more attractive than he was and who worked on more exciting files. Her name was Leah. Talk about cool. Leah was stunning, tall, intense, and her boyfriend was a famous DJ on the club music scene. They were making plans to get married at a castle in Italy. He had a fiancée, whom he was crazy about, but they were not considering European castles for their wedding. He and Leah clicked, thank God. In fact, they'd met at law school, because the space they co-occupied was tiny. Leah respected him for his intelligence, he supposed. He respected her because she was super hip, and he hoped that by working in such close proximity to one another, some of her coolness would transfer to him by osmosis. For almost 3 years, he worked out of that compact office with his beautiful and talented coworker. Back then, he wasn't issued a computer. He was provided with a dictaphone. He focused on contractual and intellectual property matters and was expected to attend a lot of entertainment events in smoke-filled nightclubs. He didn't like nightclubs, but he did like smoking. One afternoon, he received a phone call from a recruitment agent, a headhunter. "Are you interested in an in-house legal position for a large multinational?" she asked him. The headhunter said she could not identify at this time the name of the multinational, so naturally, he was immediately interested. After he hung up, he discussed the opportunity with Leah in their cramped office. They envisaged a job working for A, an oil company, or B, a pornographic magazine empire. Leah told him he'd be fantastic in either role. She was supportive. He'd scribbled down an address from the headhunter, and a couple of days later, he went to meet her during his lunch hour. The address was at a large office building in central London, in the city. He took a black cab from the hip office in the Fashion District to the bespoke-suited hub of the business world. On the way to the interview, he was anything but nervous. He wasn't actively looking for work, after all, and he hadn't applied for the job. The meeting, it turned out, was relatively casual. Let's call the headhunter Heather. Heather was a sleek and suited city woman. She was in her late 20s or early 30s, serious-minded, with large blue eyes and shampoo commercial blonde hair that was precision trimmed. She embodied the cunning corporate look in every detail. Pencil skirt and a pale blue Ralph Lauren shirt that brought out the blue in her eyes. When she first looked at him, he had the feeling of being appraised as a commodity. He was, in fact, her commodity. Their conversation felt clinical, like a doctor asking him to take his clothes off and then prodding. "Come in," she smiled. "Let's talk about this." Heather placed two glasses of ice water on the table. He was struck by the way she sipped water throughout the meeting, the motion of her mouth as she quietly emptied the cold liquid from the glass. He felt like he'd entered an icy world. She had a list of questions and opened with a personal inquiry. "Whom did you vote for in the last election?" Tony Blair had recently swept to power and hammered the Conservatives. He told Heather whom he had voted for. "Would you have a problem working in an industry which people around you were critical of?"
Sample complete. Ready to continue?